George Barron is an internationally renowned fly fisherman. Born in Scotland, he was raised in Wales, but he has a particular affection for Ireland. He recently published his second book. It's called A Fine Line, and it is a beautiful publication. I spoke to George this afternoon from his home in rural Wales. His first book, At the End of the Line, was very well received in 2016, and his latest, A Fine Line, is his second.
It is very good, and it was one I felt I really had to write after the success of the first one, because basically I didn't have enough pages to include a lot of the items and the concerns and the worries and whatever else for the future, you know. Not just new flies as such, but, you know, just to explain all the important things that fishing for wild trout has meant to me, you know.
And because you speak about your childhood, your growing up and your particular affection for wild waters.
I think, yeah, I mean, the real attraction, I grew up with wild fish in Scotland, and, you know, it was alien to me to actually start chasing rainbow trout, but the competition scene, the international scene, you know, it demanded like 3 matches out of 4 were going to be fished on artificial waters, you know. But no, there is nothing compares with a wild trout, you know.
And you have a particular affection for 2 Irish lakes.
Yeah, I would think the Corrib and Mask are likely the favourites. But I think in the international years, I fished likely internationals on 8 lochs in Ireland. But undoubtedly, the great lochs in the west are superb, you know.
What's the attraction there?
I don't really know. I think it's just that you're dealing with a wild creature. I mean, it's unadulterated, isn't it? It's not the aggression hasn't been bred out. The wildness is still there. Coloration really fits in with a, you know, if you have peat lochs, you have dark fish. Say on the Corrib, in fact, on the shallows, you'll have fish that are inclined to be light colored, and then you take a couple of fish out the deeper water, and they're dark colored. They're just marvelous fish, you know. I think they're sort of on a par with Atlantic salmon, as far as I'm concerned, you know.
How often have you come to Ireland?
I started coming over, I think, about 1990, just after, you know, there was a wee bit of an issue there, and I've been coming every, I would say, at least once a week for the duck fly, tail end of March, beginning of April, every year since then. And often topping that up with another visit later on, you know, it's fantastic. To actually be able to fish a floating line, I'm sure a fisherman would understand this, a floating line from the first week of the season would never happen in the UK. You know, the waters are colder. But the lovely thing about Loch Corrib, I think, and possibly Mask, is the fish, they breed biannually. So you've always got 50% of the fish in the lake are going to be in perfect condition and feeding. You know, you're not catching slatted fish or fish out of condition. You know, you're catching pristine conditioned fish. You know?
In your latest book, A Fine Line, you profile your favourite places, your 3 favourite places to fish.
Corrib would be the first place, undoubtedly. And you know, Mask a very close second. And when I come back closer to home, 30 years ago, I would have said Loch Leven. But the farming and the pollution and the nitrates and the phosphates have taken their toll there now. So likely locally, I would just say the mountain lakes in central Wales, you know, they don't produce big fish. Anything over a pound is normally considered a good trout. But, you know, they're lively waters, they're wild fish, they're unadulterated. It's great fishing, you know.
The phosphates and nitrates, there's something you return to again and again. What is the issue there?
I don't know if I'm clever enough to give you the answers, but I'm clever enough to see the problems. And, you know, the ecological changes that are happening, you know, the intensive farming, the agri-pollution, the phosphates, the nitrates, it's not even just that. You know, the insecticides, the herbicides, they all take their toll, you know. You've only got to open or drive across Ireland and look left or right, and you're going to be looking at blue-green fields with no wildflowers, with nothing. Everything has been killed off, and it's just a great worry for the future, you know.
And that all of that agriculture, those type of fields, it runs down into the waters and affects things,
yeah,
going on there.
But a lot of these insecticides, you know, certainly in Wales, the damage they've done is irreplaceable. I mean, nothing is ever done to improve habitat restoration or you know, regeneration and things like that. It's a great worry, and I'm not sure what's happening in Ireland at the moment, but the big issue now is to plant as many trees as you can. Well, that's fine if you're planting sort of species that will sort of support life, if you like. I mean, willow, and simple little willow will support about 200 invertebrates. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to fill that landscape with conifers and, you know, you're going back to the days of acid rain and the runoff problems that caused, you know. I mean, nothing lives in there at all. No insects as such live to improve the habitat. Commercialism really has taken over, you know.
Because it's a particular thing with conifers. They increase the acidity in an area.
They do. Well, I mean, if you look underneath a conifer tree in most of the forest, there's nothing green there. It's all dead. You know, the leaves are so acidic, or the fall-off is so acidic, you know. I don't know, it's just a dramatically changing world, and it's a great worry for the future, I think, you know. But if you're going to start improving it, if you look at a river, you've got to start improving the river at source. There's no point starting at the bottom and working your way up. You've got to start up at the top. You've got to get them healthy. You've got to get the feeder streams healthy. You've got to maybe, you don't have such a great problem in Ireland with sheep and that on the mountains, but in some parts of Wales, the land is not good. It's not arable land. It's only good to hold sheep, likely through the summer months, because it's too wild up there in the winter. Or, the plantations, the afforestation. And the sprays that used to be used, I think there's certainly a change coming, but the sprays that used to be used to treat the juvenile trees, it was just potent. It would kill everything on the ground, you know.
Let's talk about some more optimistic things at the moment, because we can still go out and enjoy these waters, particularly in this country. You have selections of flies. Now, tell me what a fly is.
Well, there are three types of fly. I mean, you've got to look at the lifestyle or the fly you're imitating, possibly first. And subsurface, you're looking at a pupa, which is very thin, very lively, and things like that. But for the angler, he's more inclined to catch the fish, or he wants to catch the fish in the surface. So he's got to dress what they call a wet fly, or even a dry fly. But you know, Ireland has the lochs in Ireland have a great history for producing great or iconic wet flies. A lot of the lochs are very shallow, or they have very shallow skerries and things like that, and wet flies are designed to create a disturbance. So you dress a fly with, you know, traditionally cock hackles would be wound up and down the length of the body, various colours and whatever else, various colours on a sunny day, various colours on a wet and a mucky windy day. But what you done, you actually, the flies were pulled across the trout's window, as it's called, you know, where it was looking, and it created a sort of slight aggression. I mean, they didn't have long to look at it in shallow water. If they decide, a trout can't pick it up with its hand and have a look at it and decide I'm going to eat it. It's got to make his mind up straight away and think, I'm going to have that, grab it, and here's your fish then.
How do you start making something like that?
We're basically following traditional patterns that have worked over the centuries, and we fine-tune them, we tweak them, and we add a bit, we take a bit off, we add better materials. It's constantly changing, but it's really very basic. You're likely putting in a small tail, or you know, we'll take a daddy long legs, for instance. You're putting in a body which is the right colour, which could be anything from raffia to fine seal's fur to hare's ear or something like that. And you're tying in bunches of legs to imitate the six or eight legs that the daddy has. And then
the leg is a knotted piece of feather.
There's various types. It's pheasant tail. Some people prefer them knotted once. Some people prefer them knotted twice. I'm not sure the trout sort of distinguishes between the two, but I think it's something to suit the individual angler or the individual fly dresser, you know.
And tying flies like this, you'd think it goes back over 1,000 years.
I think way back in Roman times, even longer than 1,000 years. They reckon about 2,000 years ago, a Roman, back in the 200 AD, they reckon was when they first recorded or referenced to fishing flies, you know. Nowadays, I mean, there's actually, fly dressing is actually a hobby. I mean, there's a lot of very, very good fly dressers. who actually don't fish, and a lot of very good fishermen who don't tie flies. So it's sort of a bonus if you are a fisherman and you know exactly what you want, tying your own flies. There is no excuses. You've actually got the ammunition you need to go out in the boat or on the loch side, you know.
And your book, A Fine Line, it's your second book.
Well, certainly the idea with the second book was to produce a book using a lot of my friends and family. We self-published this, and my granddaughter, so there was three generations of one family, we compiled the book together. In years to come, I suppose the book will be limited, and the people that do have them, it would sit on the shelf, but it won't be losing money, shall we say. That's what we're hoping. People require them personally signed. They've only got to go to George Barron Fishing, and they'll come through to me, you know.
And George's book, A Fine Line, is a beautiful production, full of illustrations and instructions. You can buy it on Amazon, or you can get it directly from George, as he said, georgebarronfishing.com, and he'll send you a signed copy. We've reported over the last couple of weeks how commercial fishermen and the shipping industry is trying to conduct business as normal. But so far this year, there's been no sailing for anybody. Dublin-based Sailing Club is the biggest sailing club in the country, with over 1,000 active members. The Commodore there is Jonathan Nicholson. I spoke to him earlier. He told me where they're at for the year.
Well, we're just in, obviously, the initial planning phases. It's clearly very difficult to plan because we don't have a clear view on what's going to happen. And you know, we will only be going sailing once the government allow it and the ISA lift their restrictions on sailing. So we are beholden to those activities being completed, I guess.
And you are by far the biggest sailing club in the country. How many boats do you have and how many members do you have?
So we have over 300 boats, over 1,200 members. We provide racing, I think, four nights a week for boats between the size of a laser and up to 43, 45-foot racing yachts.
If you're ever coming out of Dublin and looking at Dublin Bay, particularly on a Thursday night, you'll see hundreds and hundreds of boats on the horizon. That's you.
Yeah, and you know that's a result of the restrictions that have been put in place by the government, and you know the lockdown that's in place. So obviously nothing can happen until the boats go into the water, and we sort of expect we've planned out a cadence where we've got a view on a cadence of which events can happen, but it very much depends upon when the government and the ISA lift their restrictions and how much of those restrictions they actually ease. You know, we are completely beholden to them, as I said earlier on.
You still are advising people to get their boats ready?
Obviously respecting the advice or the mandate from our government. Yeah, absolutely. We expect to go racing this year. We'll be racing with a compressed schedule, definitely towards the latter end of the year. So, you know, we probably look at them. We haven't actually planned all this out completely because we don't know when we're going to go in. And, you know, a number of scenarios depend upon those dates. And but we're looking at how we can do more racing during the week. And we're looking at extending the program later on into the year beyond the traditional end of the season so we can get more races completed. So, yeah, it's our a strong desire to go sailing this year. And I think pretty much everybody feels the same way. And on that point, we've just completed a survey.
An online survey of your members, yeah.
Yeah, correct. With, you know, a huge response rate. But the overall trend is that there is a huge number of people who desperately want to get out on the water and to go sailing.
Because as well as being a major sporting event, it's also quite a social occasion for people on Thursday nights.
Yeah, it's very social, and we want to be absolutely sure that everybody understands we're only going to do what the government allows us to do. But having said that, it is very important for people. You know, for many people, it is their primary sport. Certainly, you know, for me, It allows me to completely reset on a Thursday night. I forget about absolutely everything once I step on the boat, no matter what's happening. You know, all you're doing is thinking about racing. So, yeah, we believe it's important for the national psyche to get out and to be able to enjoy sports and get racing. And, you know, we've got complete trust that that balance will be correctly found between the government and the HSE.
And let us hope we can all get back on the water within the next few weeks. But one ship which will be on the water is the Celtic Explorer. It's leaving Galway tomorrow to recover some equipment which had been laid on the seabed in the North Atlantic. Lorna Siggins has the story.
Like astronauts preparing for space, a team of scientists who have been self-isolating for the past fortnight are due to set sail on the Marine Institute research vessel Celtic Explorer this weekend from Galway on an unusual mission. The six researchers from the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies and 15 crew on the ship are going out to retrieve a network of ocean bottom sensors which were deployed across the entire offshore area about 18 months ago. And Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies School of Cosmic Physics Director Professor Chris Bean and the leader of the expedition, Dr. Sergei Lebedev, spoke to Seascapes to explain what it was all about.
My name is Chris Bean and I'm the Professor of Geophysics at the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies. So this weekend we have a team that's heading out from Galway out into the Atlantic to retrieve ocean bottom seismic equipment that was deployed last year. The project is led by Sergei Lebedev, and the equipment is run by the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies in collaboration with the ICRAG Research Centre and the Geological Survey Ireland. The vessel is run by the Marine Institute and they've been very supportive in this initiative. And the objective of this cruise is actually to retrieve this instrumentation. If we don't retrieve it now, we may lose the data. So that's where the imperative is to go at this time of crisis. So SeaSize is a project which deployed 18 seismometers, their instruments for measuring ground vibrations, all the way along the western seaboard and out into British and Icelandic waters. So it's covering a vast area offshore Ireland. So, for example, even small earthquakes could trigger a local landslide, for instance. And there are examples of landslides that can be seen, historical landslides in the area. At the early part of last century, for example, there was on the opposite side of the Atlantic, there was a very large landslide called the Grand Bank Slide in 1929 in Newfoundland. And it actually snapped lots of underground cables, triggered a tsunami, caused a lot of devastation. So there can be landslides in the offshore area, and these instruments will be able to detect maybe precursors to those, for example, or just the structural setting for those. The other thing that the instruments have is that they have what's called a hydrophone. So that is an instrument that's able to record sound in the water. So they have able to record ground vibrations, as I mentioned, you know, the whole seabed moving, but they're also able to record sound in the water. And of course, that low frequency sound that recordings will allow us to pick up whale migration, for example, through the region, and we will be working on those data in collaboration with people from the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group, for example. But you know, the data themselves are financially valuable, but they also contain a lot of really interesting information. I mean, I mentioned the Grand Bank slide on the other side. Over the Canadian side, but we also have our own local earthquakes, as I mentioned. You know, very recently, people might remember there was a magnitude 2.1 earthquake in Donegal Bay in 2019. And some people on the western seaboard up near Belmullet might remember that there was a magnitude 4.1 earthquake on the 6th of June in 2012, about 50 kilometers due west of Belmullet. So we have activity out there, and you know, the only way to really get a handle on it is to go out and install equipment in the region. But one of the primary objectives of the cruise is actually to recover this instrumentation, because there is a danger that it will be lost unless we can recover it in the very near future. And so with that in mind, you know, we have to go to sea. And we're very conscious of the fact that a lot of people have been in lockdown at home for quite some time. And, you know, the people, the crew that are going to sea have also been in lockdown at home. We're putting a skeleton crew on the boat in an effort to get out and to recover this expensive equipment and the data that's on it before it's lost.
So, Dr. Sergei Lebedev, you're looking forward to collecting data which might tell you how big storms trigger submarine landslides and tsunamis, and you're going to collect the sound of whale migrations across the ocean. Could you tell me a little bit more about what's involved?
1.5 years ago, our team from the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies has deployed a network of ocean bottom seismometers across the entire Irish offshore. A few instruments are also in the UK and Iceland waters. This is the first time that the seismic network has been deployed across a large part of the North Atlantic Ocean. So the data recorded and stored by these instruments are quite unique. And this expedition we are going on now is to recover these instruments and the data.
And you've all been self-isolating for the last couple of weeks.
We've been preparing almost like astronauts do before they go to the International Space Station, of self-quarantine and self-isolation, and will be picked up by a private bus. There is social distancing as much as possible. There are staggered meal times. Unnecessary, non-essential parts of the ship are closed off for the first 14 days, such as the gym and the sauna, which we probably wouldn't have time to use anyway. But it will be 20 days. We have a lot of distance to cover. The array, the network of the instruments is over 1,500 kilometers north to south and over 1,000 kilometers east to west. So there is more than 5,000 kilometers of distance to cover.
And how will you actually recover the sensors from the deep ocean?
Well, our instruments are at depths from 1,000 to 4,000 meters. And when we reach them, we send them an acoustic signal from our ship, and the instruments detach from the anchor that they have, and they become buoyant and slowly go to the surface. And then we have to spot them. They have a little flag, a flashing beacon for nighttime recovery, and also a radio beacon. So using one of these methods, we hope to see every one of them, and then we go and get them.
You are hoping that they are all still there?
Well, they're about 200 kilogram devices, so we know they are there. But the risk is that they either don't hear the acoustic signal, or they hear it and something went wrong and they cannot detach from their anchor. But so in more than 99% of cases, the equipment functions as it should. This data is fascinating because it's the first time it's been recorded in the large part of the North Atlantic Ocean, and we'll get recordings of earthquakes offshore Ireland. We know these are larger than onshore Ireland, but otherwise they are poorly understood. We will also use these to understand the tectonic plate that Ireland sits on and the convecting mantle beneath. This is where the volcanoes come, such as at the Giant's Causeway or in Iceland, but the mechanisms of how it happens are not clear, so we're hoping to understand that. In the North Atlantic, this has never been done by anybody. There has been attempts, but not a successful attempt to cover such a large area.
And Professor Bean, you were telling me that fishermen who know a lumpy sea will be particularly interested to know that your sensors can also record that sort of chaos in the ocean.
Instead of having a nice rolling ocean wave state, you have waves, ocean waves that are coming from different directions, and they cause a kind of a chaos in the ocean, or a kind of a lumpiness in the ocean, in the sea state. And that can generate pressure that goes all the way through the water column and interacts with the seafloor in water of arbitrary depth. Doesn't matter what depth the water is. So we're expecting, even in the Rockall Trough, for example, where the water is about 3 kilometers deep, we're expecting to see vibrations that are on the seafloor, small pressurizations of the seafloor, vibrations on the seafloor that are generated by this wave-wave interactions, ocean wave-wave interactions, by this lumpy sea on the surface. Not only does this ocean wave interaction generate pressure fluctuations on ocean-based seismometers, but it also generates small signals on land-based seismometers many thousands of kilometers away.
Thanks to Lorna Siggins.